Good evening and welcome, dear friends. It's wonderful to see you and be with you this evening. In our shared intention into Christ, behold that there is a candle that has been lit, the Christ candle, for us this evening. Let us begin in prayer. Glory to the transcendent Father and to the omnipresent Son. Into the immanent Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and will be forever. Amen. So we will begin our time, as is our custom, to listen to and be in the presence of and the direct lineage of our teachers who have gone before us. Open the door for us and shown us the way. And in addition to their vast knowledge and being, they have released a great deal of energy that we can come under directly and personal and remain connected to them during our time, especially this evening. So tonight we will be remembering Jean de Salzman, who was a very learned and adept student of Mr. Gurdjieff. Many say that she was perhaps his closest pupil for his work, and we will be drawing upon her work throughout all of this year. Her birthday was January 26, 1889. And what I'm going to read from is entitled, Seeing is an Act. And it comes from an article that was written about her works in Parabola magazine in 2017. But it also comes from her book, The Reality of Being, The Fourth Way of Gurdjieff. The question is not what to do, but how to see. Seeing is the most important thing, the act of seeing. I need to realize that it is truly an act, an action that brings something entirely new, a new possibility of vision, certainty, and knowledge. It is only in an act of seeing that I can find a certain freedom. So long as I have not seen the nature and movement of the mind, there is little sense in believing that I could be free of it. Seeing does not come from thinking. It comes from the shock in the moment when feeling an urgency to know what is true. I suddenly realize that my thinking mind cannot perceive reality. To understand what I really am at this moment, I need sincerity and humility and an unmasked exposure that I do not know. This would mean to refuse nothing, to exclude nothing, and enter into the experience of discovering what I think, what I sense, what I wish, all at this very moment. I am then open to the sense of the cosmic, beyond the realm of human perception. So this evening in particular, may we have sincerity and humility and the willingness for an unmasked exposure. This would mean to refuse nothing, not even ourselves in all of its complexity and many sides. So may it be so for us this evening. Amen. A few notes. If you signed up to participate in a journey group, your facilitator has probably already been in touch with you or will shortly be in touch with you regarding your Zoom meeting room number. And all the information about your journey group and the journey group sharing guidelines. Journey groups begin next week. Likewise, you will shortly be receiving your work partner information if you signed up for one. And finally, I would like to invite everyone, especially the Oblates and those who are members of the Oblate Circle of Devotion, to be sure and be present next Thursday night, the February 11th, as it will be a special one, and we will include the dedication that is the rite of Oblates and the rite of Oblate Circle of Devotion. Everyone is invited to attend and to participate in this dedication, but especially those who are, of course, making this vow. So let us prepare to enter into Lectio Divina. And we place ourselves in a place of imminent trust, humility, receptivity to receive the influences coming from the circle of conscious humanity. And we prepare to receive these influences this evening. We breathe in deeply the gift of life and hold this rare and precious gift that is my life, Christ's life evolving in me. And with our collective breath, we hold it for a moment and then breathe out this healing goodness into our world. We hand over the complexities of the day, the plans for tomorrow, the anxieties and small fears of our hearts. We lay down anything that is constructed in order to yield to the divine human life. And we are encumbered before God and one another. I will now share with you on the screen our reading for this evening. And you may wish to read along with me, or perhaps just to listen, or to gaze at the image and see how it evokes and touches another center with what is being read. And we can maintain this parallel focus, if you will, between seeing and hearing and sensing and thus knowing. Be transformed by the renewing of your minds, and may the eyes of your heart may be enlightened. A person unites with truth only through love, as it were, and in this way one's being is changed. This work is beautiful. It is about liberation. It is as beautiful as if locked for years in prison, you see a stranger entering who offers you a key. But you may refuse it because you have acquired prison habits and have forgotten your origin, which is from the stars. These practices of the work help open the eye of our heart, and this leads us to the expression, the wish is father to the thought. be transformed by the renewing of your minds. And may the eyes of your heart be enlightened. A person unites with truth only through love, as it were. And in this way, one's being is changed. This work is beautiful. It is about liberation. It is as beautiful as if locked for years in prison. You see a stranger entering who offers you a key. But you may refuse it because you have acquired prison habits and have forgotten your origin, which is from the stars. These practices of the work help open the eye of our heart. This leads us to the expression, the wish is father to the thought. Be transformed by the renewing of your minds, and may the eyes of your heart be enlightened. A person unites with truth only through love, as it were. And in this way, one's being is changed. This work is beautiful. It is about liberation. It is as beautiful as if locked for years in prison. You see a stranger entering who offers you a key, but you may refuse it because you have acquired prison habits and have forgotten your origin, which is from the stars. These practices of the work keep open the eye of our heart. This leads us to the expression, the wish is father to the thought. Amen. I now invite you, as you are moved to do so, to simply raise your hand, and you will be called upon to share. Suzanne Sanders, please. You just, there you go.
That was so beautiful. I think I heard the wish is father to the thought. And it reminded me of our aims, but it also reminded me of my affirmations every day. Mm. And how much they've changed and expanded my heart. And just recently I've been saying or asking God to purify my heart and my thoughts and my voice. And I feel like that is my biggest wish, to bring love into my thinking and especially to my voice that I say every day to anyone that I come across.
It's beautiful, Suzanne. Thank you. And it's rare that we mention our voice, but how important it is. May it be so. Billy, please.
Hello, Mary Ann.
Good evening, Billy and Brad.
There was so much that was so beautiful in that reading, but what really has captured me was the image. And I saw so much, so many levels in the image. The background alone was, to me, like the night sky, the cosmos. And then the sort of opening of this container and all of these fragments pouring out. And there were so many fragments you couldn't count them. And I equated all of this to the unloading process that we know of in centering prayer, but also seeing all those fragments, all the various eyes, and they were all different colors, reflecting all different colors of the spectrum, of the light spectrum. And I thought about that and thought, there's nothing that isn't included. Even the dark ones are included.
Yes.
So all of those fragments that I sometimes think I want to get rid of are really there as part of the big picture.
Yes.
And have to be there.
That's so right.
That was, I love that image.
Yes, in all its beauty. Thank you, Billy. It's wonderful. Marcia Silver, please.
Well, I too was drawn mostly to the image, although the words that came to me immediately was at the very beginning, also be transformed by the eyes of your heart being enlightened. And
yes,
when I heard that and was looking at that image, I saw the same kind of background that she did with the stars, but I saw the image with all the fragments in it as me in my life. And my eye went immediately to the lightest one, the one that is like rising up from the bottom there. And I feel that that is kind of representing me since I've been in the work. I before would have been very drawn to the darker colors, the brighter colors, but to see that the one that's closest to white, almost at the top of that, reaching back up to the stars, I just feel that made me feel very hopeful, and also that I am changing, truly changing in my focus and seeing the positive as opposed to the negative first. So that seems to me to be pretty important.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Marcia. It's beautiful. David Wallace, please.
Hi, Mary Ann.
Oh, hello, David. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too. I too was taken by the image. The reading was lovely, but the image really stood out because what landed for me was that centerpiece where it was basically what I saw as pixels that was magnified in to a microscopic degree. I saw that as a snapshot of that complete image, the sphere. If you were to back that image out, you know, 100,000 times to the full image. And what I saw in there was that you had all of these different pixels that were different shapes and different colors. And it reminded me how important the particularity of all of us is, that we all are unique and special and needed. But then when you pull back to see the entire body, it's one uniform thing. So it was just this idea that it's so important that we understand our preciousness and that we all matter, but we're part of the bigger picture.
Wonderful. Another wonderful reflection. Thank you, David. Isn't it incredible how we each see something wondrous and it all adds to the facets of the one. Someone else. Is that Pam? It's good to see you, Pam.
Acquiring prison habits is something I've done all my life. I am so comforted by discovering the peace and the love in my morning sits before the birds begin to sing, the prayer and the reading that I've been blessed with by being involved with our church. It doesn't matter anymore if there was ever a prison to me, because I am feeling liberated. Truly am. I thank all of you.
Thanks be to God. Thank you, Pam. Jonathan, please.
Thank you. Yeah, the exercise, the Lexio and Visio all at once was a different experience than I've had before with just Lexio. And it seemed like it was a practice in divided attention right then and there. The words that struck me most were, the work is beautiful. It's for liberation. And the part below that was just spoken to reminded me of the poem from Hafiz, the Persian poet, where he says, the small man builds cages for everyone he knows, while the sage who has to duck low so he doesn't hit his head on the moon drops keys for all the rowdy prisoners. Mm-hmm. And that small man, that imbalance of the centers, just seemed like the liberating invitation of the Lexio was to do that to myself. So thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. How very rich all of these sharings have been. I know the eyes of my own heart have been opened by what each of you have shared. And I know there's much more. But we will close this period of our evening. And thank you. Thank you. It is now my pleasure to introduce Peter. He will speak to us following on our Lexio of the purification and illumination of the emotional center. And his will be the concluding teaching and message from part one of our curriculum, which was entitled Overture of the Emotional Center. And in these first 4 weeks, the idea was to give you a touch of the various ideas and topics and explorations that we will have and unfold more deeply as the year unfolds. So Peter, welcome, and we look forward to your being and presence with us this evening.
Well, thank you, Marianne, and thank you for everyone's share when the Lexio is so meaningful. And thank you for your presence here tonight. It's so meaningful to be together like this and be seekers and on the way, learning together. Gratitude to Michael Begeman, who led us in the last two Thursday classes. And just from my experience, it just felt like Michael turned a whole new page for us in the depth and integration of ideas. And both evenings spoke very much to me in different ways and taught me something new and helped me integrate a few things in my own life. So I was very, very, very blessed by the last two Thursday nights, and we'll carry forward that wish to continue to be a blessing through these ideas. I'm going to share the screen here and just for a moment, just as we can orientate ourselves and remind everyone of our flow of each class. You're probably getting a sense that we open with an opening prayer and perhaps some announcements, and then we do the Lexio. And then we go to a period of time of reporting on our homework from the week prior, which is an opportunity to share how we put on the ideas and not just thought about them, but tried to apply them in our lives. And so last week, Michael's homework to us was to read a certain portion of the commentaries. And then in particular, this is the one I invite everyone to share. If you feel led to share how this went for you. And I'll read the homework. The homework was, as a result of imaginary identification, the simple knowing of our own ground of being is veiled, and we are absent from our true identity, instead attaching our sense of I to temporary fragments. And here was the homework. Observe for a day the number of times and ways you say, I am hungry, I am sad, whatever the case may be, and fill in the blank. And then the other invitation was to work on self-remembering every day, at least once a day. So I wonder who are the courageous ones who will be willing to edify us by your sharing your humanity, your experience of what did you see about all the I am statements you make during the course of a day? And how did it go for you in the practice of self-remembering every day? Who would like to share first tonight? You can just raise your hand and then we will unmute you. Kira Ely, that could be Sandra or it could be Ken, I suspect. Just go ahead.
Yes, that's Ken. Right, Peter. I'll get to the I am. I hadn't actually thought about it through that angle, but there is an I am in here. I also wanted to express gratitude for Michael. His nine box little quadrant tool was, I had a range of experience when he showed that. One was, wow, this is, pretty cool. I can see how the evolution of the work and, you know, making things simpler is quite helpful. I also thought, well, 20 years in the work, why haven't I seen that before? And I thought, well, why didn't I come up with that? So I had all these things going on. But I was actually in the pursuit of the prior week's homework, and the nine box was helpful in doing that. So I'll just share on that a number of years ago, I was traveling in Asia with a local colleague, and It was the weekend and we were doing some sightseeing. And somewhere in there, she just stopped and said, Ken, do you know that you sigh a lot? And of course, I didn't know that. But ever since then, I've not been able to not notice when I sigh. And it's not a like an exasperated sigh. It's more an exhalation of a deep breath that's going on. And as I kind of started using the pieces of the box to kind of explore this, you know, clearly that the sigh itself is just coming from the moving part of the moving center. It's just a reflex. But I wondered about the idea that was planted that caused that reflex. And this is where the IM comes in. It's this idea of I'm behind. You know, there's more that needs to be done. There's this kind of urgency that's just pushing forward. So there's more exploration there. The other thing that I noticed is when I actually observe the sigh, when I put attention on it, it triggers another eye that kind of lives in the emotional part of moving center. And this one is more about survival. It actually moves the body into it forces the deep breath all the way to the lungs having to be filled. And if the lungs don't get filled, then there's another breath. And if it doesn't happen soon, then there's a panic. So it's something I've observed quite a bit. Obviously more to go here, but I found the tool very useful. The only other thing I would say is I've also noticed how this is something that is pretty deep seated, that there's a lot of eyes that have kind of kept this exploration at arm's length, and having something new, having a new way to look at it. That little nine box was quite useful. So I'm very grateful for that. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, Ken. I'm grateful for your vulnerable sharing. And it sheds light on the nuance of the whether or not it's the emotional part of the moving center or the moving part of the emotional center, how sighs and, as Marianne was saying, our voice, how so much shows up in our facial expressions, our little subtle muscles in our face and our sighing and our voice. It's fascinating to observe. And what I love most about your report is that you acknowledge that without, in a certain sense, without this colleague alerting you, you wouldn't have known it. So these things are hidden to us. We're blind to them. They're definitely blind spots. Anyway, thank you, brother. Lisa Morgan, please.
Good evening. I really echo Ken. I love the tool and the way that Michael gave the example, and it did open that up to me using the nine box. And when he brought it up, I immediately knew what I wanted to use that for. And was excited, and then I had all the procrastination eyes come up where you find other things to do, you know, to sort of avoid it. You know, my new experience is the having my mother live with us for 6 months, and that has just presented its challenges. And in doing this box, it was a lot harder than I thought it was. I realized that it was it was hard for me to get out of a state of identification while I was writing it out, because I actually drew the little boxes that Michael did and wrote it out. And I came to where my work is and where the crux of my relationship is with my mother in this phase of our experience together. And it's feeling inauthentic because one, I'm a 3 on the Enneagram and I have trouble, I avoid my emotions. So I have trouble connecting to how am I feeling and being able to articulate that. My mom is the same way. So we have a lack of expression of our feelings to break the ice with the tension. And then that oozes out in me of being very impatient, having impatient eyes or snapping at my mother because I feel like we're not allowing ourselves space to be authentic, to be intimate, and to be able to express what's happened. You know, we're both living a different experience with each other, and it's this avoidance that is painful. And so this tool was useful to get down to what I believe is the emotional part of the emotional center, that core of where there's a lack of expression of the emotions and being able to process and not identify and to self-remember, you know.
Yeah.
There's a loop of identification that I'm trying to get out of, quite frankly. So thank you.
Well, thank you for sharing the insight. You're in a loop. And I think just by acknowledging in that, I think you stepped out of the loop. perhaps. One of the thought that emerged as you were sharing, the funny way the phrase "I am a daughter," or "I am a mother," or "I am a father," that phrase, you know, we tend to give ourselves a pass on those primary relationships. I am a husband. I am a wife. We don't really ever look at those statements or include them in that self-observation, but there's so much identification in that "I am" statement. It may be one of our primary roots, perhaps. So I notice that I'm different when I am a son in those relationships. So anyway, thank you very much. Karen, please, and then Jeffrey.
Well, so I didn't do the homework exactly like it's prescribed, I guess. I focused and was appreciative of Michael's inclusion of, for self-observation, the topical, concrete, non-critical observation. And I have been working with that for quite a while, mostly on the side of non-critical, because it seems fairly straightforward for me to be able to not identify with, not identify, but to observe an I that is acting out, even the more damaging ones. The challenge I have is when there are other eyes that come up to criticize. And it's very easy for me to get embedded in those and then not be able to get to the non-identify. So if I'm able to non-critically self-observe, then I have half a chance of getting to the non-identifying. In fact, it feels like the non-identification and the topical concrete, those are kind of like bridges to getting to non-identify. Like they've got to be there. You can't really like just jump over the lake and you're there at non-identify. But then it also gets me wondering and thinking, well, how is that all connected? Are those completely different eyes that are judgmental, or are they parts of centers of an eye that are all working in cahoots together? Because sometimes it has felt like some of my observations are there just for the purpose of bringing up the criticizers. Like there's some part of me that I don't know if it needs to do the beat up, but I think it's rooted in the Catholic schoolgirl from very young that, you know, at our core, we're not good. We're sinful, and we've got to constantly be, you know, confessing our sins and getting absolved of our sins before we can even move on. So there's more to go there, but that non-critical is so absolutely important in self-observation. Like if you don't do that, you can't even claim to non-identify, or maybe some people can, but what I've recognized, like, that it's not going anywhere if I'm stuck in the criticizer, and even like the slightest amount.
Yes, thank you, Karen. And some of us have a predisposition more towards that self-criticism than others. And so it just becomes such an important part of the self-observation, the non-critical self-observation. That's very insightful in what you just shared, in that it's like a precursor to non-identification. And it really raises an interesting question for me, is am I really not identified if I'm critical in my self-observation? And so that emotional judgment that I have against myself or whatever it might be in the self-observation is very, very good reminder for all of us to self-observe non-critically.
I wanted to acknowledge Lisa's article too. I read that and I saw in there, Lisa, where you caught yourself criticizing yourself in your observations. So yeah. Like, right on, sister.
Amen.
Article.
And just one other reflection to Byron Katie, she's got in terms of the how, some of us might be asking, well, how do I non-critically self-observe? She's got a little phrase that helps me all the time. And it's a very simple one. Who would I be without this thought? Mm. And that helps me out of my self-critical moments. Who would I be without this thought? Thank you. Blessings. Jeffrey, please.
I'm relatively new to this particular process, but I've been through this before in other ways, some of them associated with this organization. So my observations may be less sophisticated, but I noticed during the week as I went through the exercise of self-remembering and noting the number of times that I said I am, even to myself. For example, I said, I am very tired. And in doing so, identified with my move element, identified with my body, and became literally a tired person rather than having a tired body. I meant, I should say, I feel tired, or my body is really tired. Now that's a little bit, I think, stilted to say my body is tired. But I realized the number of times during the week, as I observed myself, as I self-remembered, that I was saying, I am frustrated, I am tired, all those I ams. And in doing so, I felt that I was reducing my entire existence to an emotion, or to a physical feeling, emotional feeling in my physical, my move center in my body. And I just wanted to thank all of you for bringing this to my attention. It's an interesting exercise to self-observe again, to remember myself, and to remember that I am not tired. I am not frustrated. I may be feeling frustrated at that moment, but if I'm feeling frustrated, I can identify where it's coming from and I can deal with it very nicely. But if I am frustrated, if I become the physical embodiment and spiritual embodiment of frustration, there's absolutely nothing I can do about that except be frustrated. So I wanted to thank you very much.
Amen, Jeffrey. That is it. Whatever fear you had about not communicating clearly in the system, you just said it to the truth, and you couldn't say it any clearer. So thank you. Yes, the I am statements reveal how much we give our power away, our words at the very least, are imprecise and not accurate, and they don't represent reality. One of the things that I learned in this work when we used to meet in Thursday nights in the sanctuary is putting the finger into the face like this and literally saying, this is not I. This is called feeling tired, or this is called the sensation of tiredness occurring in the body. And just sometimes in those really entrenched I am statements or identification, pulling this finger out and looking at it, it's as if it helps me self-observe and pull out of myself. So that can be a useful little practice when you notice you're struggling with the identification. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Leslie, please.
I had an experience in observing a week or so ago. I live with my children and grandchildren, son and went to French bakery, and he brought back everyone what they like, what kind of croissant or cinnamon roll, and he didn't bring me one. He just didn't think of it. And I said something like, well, my favorite would be buttery croissant. My mind, that silly, completely. I so kicked really deep. And so I knew it was, well, that I had to spend some time in. Explore the emotional center. And so I went back to my meditation place and went inside and spent some time with Dad and with Mom when I was and being about or that left out, not important, not careful. A lot of that tells that. Yeah, the negative completely left. And so I'm so grateful for the work, because before I wouldn't have noticed that in my body, just just lived on in my stomach. So thank you for.
Thank you, Leslie, for sharing. I'm going to go to Christina Cochran, please.
Yes. Can you, am I unmuted?
Yes, you are.
Oh, okay. So I was listening to the class again in my car, and I'm driving, and we got to the piece about the homework being self-remembering. And I looked up and I saw a sign, highway sign, that said junction. And I was like, self-remembering junction. It just was like it just struck me that self-remembering a junction, that it's an opportunity, it's an option, it's a choice. And just how clearly it was like kind of almost lectio visio, because I can still remember so clearly the letters are white and reflective. And again, it was the reflective nature of the letters in self-remembering, sort of bringing into my mind this very personal relationship with God and being in the vertical, and that the letters are so clear and so simple and direct. So I was really thankful that junction can now is part of this idea of self-remembering for me.
Thank you, Christina. That's insightful for all of us to remember that most of us forget to self-remember much of the day. We have experiences of it from time to time, but signs like that come along sometimes and trigger us or help us remember our aim to self-remember. So it's a common experience in the work that something helps us remember. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much. Sometimes it literally is a sign.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bless you. Duberly, we'll conclude with you. If you can report briefly, that would serve all of our purpose.
Hey, Peter. Real quick, I also worked with the quadrant that Michael gave an example with, and I wanted to point out, I guess, that Michael had asked a question, and he said, a work view of what Mrs. Pam? And it's a very interesting because I did it around money. And all my aversions around spending money. And I realized that the way I phrased that question or that opening statement made a big difference. I ended up saying a work view on what spends money. And it's a good way to go to what Karen was saying, to not identify this what thing is inside of me. And it helps me not take it personally when I ask the question that way, and it makes it easier for me to fill out this quadrant. And real quick, I also noticed that I started with the idea of trying to understand what doesn't like spending money inside of me. And I realized that there's a whole group of eyes that are as frivolous and enjoy spending money. Somewhat a big realization. Anyways, thank you.
That's good. So the eyes in you that don't want to spend money get a hold of something sometimes a little more powerfully.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, brother. All right. Let's just send gratitude to those who have shared, and thank you for embodying these ideas in a practical way. It's such a gift to hear each of us share how we're putting the ideas on. I'm going to share the screen in just a moment, but tonight we're going to explore a bridge that connects the work and Christianity. It's a bridge that has been around from the beginning, probably, and what we discover is that what the work talks about in terms of making personality passive and making the emotional center less negative, working on that, working on not expressing negative emotions, is a very similar way spoken about in Christianity in terms of the purification of the emotional center or the purity of the heart. And there were practices and you might say processes for doing that in Christianity early on. And there are practices and processes for doing that in the work. And one of the aims that I hope comes from the sharing tonight is that we begin to see that the work and Christianity are really just the same thing. And the work gives us a much more precise language psychologically to talk about the how. And that's one of the gifts that's been to my life. Not that I'm the greatest representative of what the work does in someone's life, but it has helped me out significantly. So I'm going to share the screen and we'll continue with the teaching tonight, which is unfolding the emotional center a little bit more and putting it in conversation with the Christian concept of the dark nights, and in particular, the dark night of the spirit. As you know, we've been covering the emotional centers. We started out talking about the emotional center, and then we went into the different parts of the centers. But just as a reminder, as a shorthand way of conceiving what we are, the experience of being human, it's a very intuitive, very simplistic model that basically just says body, emotions, and thinking, mind. So mind, heart, body. Now we know that we're not that simple, but this stack of three centers is a lovely way to conceptualize ourselves very quickly on the fly, to quickly see where our energy is. Is it in the head? Is it in the heart? Is it in the body? And there are these other two centers down here, the instinctive center and the sexual center. We combine moving and instinctive. We follow the teaching of Maurice Nicol, who combined them. And we don't talk much about the sexual center at all in our work conversations for obvious reasons. And the because all of this can be, in a sense, lumped together. But the interesting thing here is the question, what are the higher intellectual center and higher emotional center? And this is something that is not so self-explanatory if you're just looking at it from a anthropological point of view. So the work calls these centers already existing in us, fully formed, we're just disconnected from them, or we get disconnected from them. There's not much communication going on. And these higher centers are our possibility of development as we continuously increase our connection to them. The work calls them higher centers. Christianity might call them something different, but nevertheless, there's this concept that we can develop more than we are, that we have a capacity greater in us than what might be self-evident or just have been acquired by life and family and education. Another visual of what centers are, obviously that's a very, almost like a electrical diagram that you'd see. Here's a different image that conveys, I think, the interrelatedness of the centers, because clearly the centers aren't compartmentalized as this image suggests. This is a very helpful image, but there is clear interrelatedness of all the centers. So for those visual among us, perhaps this is useful to see the human experience. At all the time, all the centers are experiencing something. Another way of thinking about this is very simple, of just stacking the human being. We'll be talking about this next week. And what's interesting is that some of us are more emotional centered people, and then we're more intellectual and then moving. Some people are primarily moving and then intellectual, and you can stack them in different ways in terms of your functioning and your preferences. But again, this is a very simplistic way of approaching how to describe what a human being is and what the process of being human involves. Now, the emotional center is, for most of us, the place where we're going to need to do the most significant work. And if not the emotional center, then most likely, at least for most of us, one of the emotional parts of the other centers is going to be the place where we do a significant amount of inner work. And that is the case for several reasons. We can't get into all of that now. But in a certain sense, what the Christian doctrine of original sin may have meant is really that there's not clear communication between the centers, and the centers are not being used in the way they should. In other words, instead of meeting the world intellectually, we then meet it emotionally, and it creates a problem. We react, for example, from anger, whereas we could stay more rational in our mind. We also know that a lot of science, modern science, has helped us see that the brain in its two hemispheres and its at least three dimensions, prefrontal cortex, the amygdala, the reptilian brain, all of these functions in the brain affect us in our hormones and in our glands. So the emotions become very fast and very significant way that ties things together, sometimes in a way that creates a mess. So having a pie chart like this from an intellectual perspective helps us kind of discover ourselves. And while this isn't the best picture, you can find it starting on page 77 in the commentaries. What we see here is that you can begin to identify, as Michael did 2 weeks ago, which part of the emotional center is functioning here. Like Ken sighing, where might that be occurring in the emotional center? And so one of the blessings of the pie charts is if we do it ourselves, if we create our own personal pie chart by self-observation, it can really be useful to see, okay, I'm using the wrong center for this task. I need to change centers. I need to breathe. I need to go outside. I need to do something different so I get in a different center. I need to stop yelling, this sort of thing. I need to pause and take a time out. So we teach our children this, and somehow as adults, we tend to forget. But the emotional center becomes the place where so much of what we might think of as what's wrong with humankind and our inability to get along with others and the history of violence on this planet is rooted in the emotional center and its miswiring and misfiring. Very quickly, and then we'll move into the purification part. Another way of conceiving or picturing the different inner parts of the emotional center, all interrelated. So I like the pie chart, but this also conveys that interrelatedness, that they're all impacting each other. And I showed this the first week. This takes the pie charts and kind of creates that interrelatedness factor. And it's very useful to just see how all of them tie together and impact each other, the different functions of the center, especially the emotional center. What I like to point out is that the positive emotions, positive side of the emotional center has the emotional part of the emotional center has religious emotions, aesthetic emotions like for art and beauty, and moral emotions, and probably the seat of our conscience. Similar to the positive part of the intellectual part of the emotional center is this place where artistic creation occurs and where this thing called magnetic center, which draws us to truth and activates something in us to seek for something more than what life might be offering us. And so this is a very useful way to quickly see where we might be and to find yourself in here and to perhaps even write some of your own experiences and fill in the blanks. You can review a lot of this in the different emails that have already been sent out and from last year as well. So we're gonna move on, that was a bit of review, and talk now about the purification of the emotional center, its cleansing, its unloading. Rami Shapiro is a beautiful teacher and being, Jewish rabbi. He wrote a book that I think is the best 12-step book that dovetails with spirituality, Christianity, and Islam and Judaism, all the major religions. He integrates it so beautifully. But he has this awesome quote on page 172, and he says, "I don't want to stop feeling. I want to stop being driven by my feelings." And that is a very important thing for any one of us who has discovered that we're helpless or we're powerless over our emotions or powerless over a sensation that we wish to satisfy by drinking or eating. I don't want to stop feeling. And we could add, I don't want to stop being a human being. I don't want to stop being a physical embodied being on this planet. I don't want to be an angel. I don't want to be a pure spirit. I want to be fully human in this body for as long as I possibly can. I don't want to stop feeling. I want to stop being driven by my feelings. Another way of saying that is I wish to be more conscious in my expression of my emotions. And in the work, there's an analogy, what they used to call the rogue elephant. And the emotional center can sometimes be the rogue elephant. And rogue elephants are kind of like when elephants go crazy, they tromp through the woods and they do terrible damage. And the emotions are kind of like that. When we get out of control in our emotional center, it can be like a wild elephant just tearing through the jungle. And it turns out one of the ways, so they say, they train or help heal crazy elephants is that they bring two sane elephants on either side of the rogue elephant. And so you can begin to see an analogy here of the intellectual center in the body, the moving instinct, bring these two centers along to kind of help the emotional center. And that's a lovely way of thinking about what happens when our emotional center acts up in unconscious ways. The rogue elephant is a famous analogy. So too is the analogy of the carriage, the horse, driver, and the master, or real I. I prefer the word real I because the word master has associations with it that are, I think, socially inappropriate given our history with slavery. But nevertheless, that's the classic description of the analogy. And we don't really use horse and buggies anymore, but you can see here the analogy as you know what the carriage is. It's the thing that holds us. It's our body. The horses are our emotions. They and our will. They pull us where they will. But left alone, they'll just go wherever they want. So you've got a driver who's got the horses, got the emotion by the reins, and this is supposedly the intellectual center. But again, think this is an interrelated system, mind, body, emotions. But notice there's someone sitting in the carriage, and this is master or real I. This is that in us which tells the driver where to go, so to speak. And this quality in us can increase and be developed. And certainly some people have a master that can be quite, shall we say, evil. They can be quite powerful at using the whole system in a very destructive way. So master can show up in all sorts of different ways. And this is where, dovetailing this with Christianity becomes so important because it contains the wish not to become a superhuman, but to become like Jesus, who in Philippians chapter 2 wasn't so proud that he couldn't humble himself, so to speak, and that love is what is most important. So the point about the idea of this master in the horse, driver, and carriage analogy is that there's something more than just the body, emotions, and intellect. And that hints at and points to the higher centers. So I think there's some connection between master, real I, and the higher centers. And we'll have to leave it there and explore that another time. Mr. Gurdjieff has a way of saying things that are so memorable and land ideas deeply. And some of his statements, because he didn't speak English very well, are so memorable. And he has a way of putting things. And this quote is from Life is Real Only Then When I Am. And he says, regarding emotions and the emotional center, being able not to identify with the external manifestations of others becomes one of the aims of the work, that we have the capacity to not be identified with someone else's manifestation, especially toward us. Can we stay calm in the presence of someone yelling at us or criticizing us? If we don't feel calm, can we at least work at not expressing our disdain or hatred and feeding it back and making the fire worse? This is an extraordinary wish for all of us to get to this place where we do have the freedom not to be identified with someone's external manifestation. And we can practice this in all sorts of ways with the people we live with and love. We can practice this with people who we watch on the news in situations that occur day to day, whether it's someone driving beside you or someone standing in line at the grocery store. You can explore how hard it is to not identify with an external manifestation that someone is giving or sharing in your space or on your TV. This really gets to the fact that, number one, we're responsible for our reactivity. We're responsible for our perceptions of others. And we have the freedom to choose how we respond. And we can cultivate that freedom more and more. But for most of us, that level of freedom is very limited. We tend to be quite programmed, mechanical, and habituated in our reaction to the external manifestations of others. And just becoming aware of that, like Ken became aware of his sighing, is progress and development. So now let's get to the purification of the emotional center in terms of how this emotional center starts to get healed. But before I move on, I'm just going to stop the share and pause and see if anyone has a comment or a question that would be useful for the topic at hand. Anyone have a comment or question? Just raise your hand if you wish. Going once, going twice. Back to Peter. Okay. So Maurice Nicol has this lovely insight in his commentaries. The peculiar characteristic of negative emotions is that they go on and on by themselves, always creating fresh negative emotions long after the first cause is removed. And they take so much energy and waste it uselessly so that people often become ill as a result. So there's just a couple things to draw our attention to. First, when it comes to the emotional center, the primary issue is, I think, as I've looked at it in my own life, number one, I get identified. It's like red wine pressed in a white tablecloth. Good luck getting that stain out. I get so identified with a thought, a feeling, or a sensation, that it's almost as if I am that thought, feeling, or sensation. So this at heart is what is in need of healing for most of us as human beings, is the addiction to identification. And so negative emotions become one of the main areas where we get identified. And when identification happens, it tends to birth more negative emotions. And that's the second part, is that they can oftentimes be self-replicating. And if you've ever observed it in yourself, it kind of becomes like a snowball oftentimes, and it gets worse and worse in terms of the intensity and also the scope of what you might have been feeling. So you might start out feeling angry, which isn't exactly a negative emotion, but when that anger turns into loathing or hatred or violence, then it has turned into negativity. And then the last thing I'll point out, and I think all of us can verify this in our own life, these negative emotions take so much energy and waste it uselessly. So identification also wastes energy in us. So you can be so exhausted at the end of the workday, not because you've had a hard workday, but because you've been identified with your colleague who didn't praise you in the way you thought you should have been praised or something like this. And so you've been bitter. And it's been leaking all day. Your energy has been leaking all day. And we all know what ends up happening then. In order to feel sort of self-soothe, we turn to food or drink or some sort of activity, sometimes not always the most conscious activity, to kind of appease this sense of depletion. In contrast, just sitting in silence and meditation could be useful or healthier. Taking a walk in nature could be healthier, or just self-observing and seeking to bring more attention into a different center than the one that might be consuming your energy. This all is a part of the important work of the purification of our emotional center. And it's a lifetime of work, or at least a significant chunk of our life. What is it that needs unloading and healing? And I'm not going to go into this very much. I just want to give you an idea that the work has very precise descriptions of what Christianity just lumps in and calls sin. So the work gives this nuancing to help us see what needs unloading and healing so that we can be more or less saint-like, so that we can have the mind of Christ, so that we can, as it were, be conformed to the image of God and likeness more. And so these work terms we'll be exploring this year, and you can go back in the glossary on the church website, the Journey School archives. These are brilliant expressions of what's gunking us up as human beings. And we'll go into each of them throughout the year. Programs for Happiness is Thomas Keating's term. And Thomas Keating's Programs for Happiness were also related around three centers, essentially. And we won't get into that, but you see a lot of dovetailing between Thomas Keating and in this particular area of his unloading, what happens in centering prayer, and our awareness of what programs are being frustrated in our day-to-day life. And so there's a lot of crossover. So how? And this gets us to the heart of what we want to talk about tonight. And how does this purification happen? How can we become more balanced, more awake, more conscious in our relating to ourselves, to others, to God, to the world, to our animals, to the flowers, to our breath? So this is a lifelong journey and exploration for all of us. Here's a little mapping of three systems that are very similar. And this starts to get at the how question. And the main idea here isn't to go into depth in each of these paths. The main idea is to show you the somewhat universal repeating threefold nature of things. And this helps us see that there is a significant connection between Christianity and the work in this area. And so tonight we'll be looking a little bit at John of the Cross's teaching. John of the Cross structured the process of the spiritual life as one of the dark night of the sense and the dark night of the spirit. And these could interweave with each other. They could be occurring at the same time, but typically they don't. They happen in phases or sequentially. But there's a movement toward this deeper level of being or high quality of being, which he calls spiritual marriage or union of lover and beloved. And so we're going to talk a little bit about what John of the Cross might be referring to. But notice how I've just taken the liberty to kind of wonder where some of the key work ideas would land in John of the Cross's system. And we'll go into deeper depth in just a moment. But next week, we'll be talking about man number 1, 2, and 3, and man number 4, 5, 6, and 7. So these are placeholders, but I wanted just to draw some comparisons. John of the Cross has a way of structuring the spiritual journey so that it seems like you could kind of map it out. Now, this is useful to a certain extent, because it helps us see, number one, that there are clear markers of development. And number two, that it's not just one dark night, there's multiple dark nights. But there is a movement toward what Christianity calls being a saint or being perfect or union, divine union. And what the work calls real eye, balanced man, a man number 5, 6, and 7, and other terms. In my experience, my lived experience is less like this clear-cut map. You tell me if this resonates. My lived experience feels much more like this, a beautiful chaos, a symphony of soul, that all sorts of different things are happening at the same time in an interrelated holy mess. And that feels more true to my experience than that. But I am perhaps more of an emotional person, and so maybe more of an intellectual person, this might feel more like a reflection of their life. But whatever the case may be, however you map the journey, there is one journey and endless maps. But there's a lot of resonance of the maps. And that's one of the things I hope you see tonight, is the similarities between the map of the work and the map of Christianity. So John of the Cross structures spiritual journey in what he calls the nights. And you might ask someone when they say, I'm in a dark night, which night? Because John says there's two nights, the night of sense and the night of spirit. But actually there's four nights, because he breaks those up into active nights and passive nights. The main thing that I want to focus on here is that in the active night and the active night of the sense and the active night of the spirit, there is a, you might say this is the rough sandpaper where God begins to work on us, spirit begins to work on us with significant, you might say, intensity related to our body and our emotions. And this oftentimes happens early on in the journey, where some of our deepest attachments, or how they're expressed as passions like greed, gluttony, lust, anger, sloth, how they get expressed. And so early on in our spiritual journey, a lot of these big ticket items that have dominated our emotional center get worked on. This is the low hanging fruit. And for many people, it takes a life crisis to start to work on these things. But this often is where we all start. And then the active night of the spirit is similar, except it has more to do with the movement from discursive prayer, like praying with words, to the attraction to praying in the silence. But the active night of sense is really the purgative way, and it is the place where we see where'd it go? There it is. It is where we see self-observation, non-identification, working toward making personality passive. This is some of the first things we do in the work. And I think it relates very much to the night of sense. Now, the night of the spirit, these passive nights, is very interesting, because in John of the Cross's teaching, he basically says the passive nights are what you don't do and God does for you. And this becomes a place where, in terms of the how of our transformation and purification of the emotional center, there is a point on many of our journeys where we can't see what we need to be worked on. We don't see ourselves, and it's harder to see because so much has been taken away and transformed. And as we develop, we need help from above, so to speak. And this is in, I think, work terms, where things like higher emotional center and higher intellectual center starts to appear and help us and work on these very subtle energies in us, that purification of the finest level, kind of radical non-identification and deep self-remembering, not only just experiences of self-remembering, but longer states or longer times in that state of self-remembering. And I know this is all a lot all at once, but the main idea I wish to share is to see how the work and an early mapping of the Christian way of purgation and transformation have a lot in common, and that the work isn't anything new, and it certainly isn't outside of Christianity. It falls squarely within the monastic tradition that dealt with how we deal with our passions and how we develop into saints. And what the world needs is more conscious harmony and more saints. And so what a gift to have the work give us such clear guidance in terms of the how. So that's all I have for this evening in terms of the teaching. The homework is listed in the email, and I encourage you to continue with the homework. especially uncritically self-observe identification with negativity and observe states of self-remembering. Describe and contrast the difference of energy, sensation, and experience. What do you see? What additional understanding about yourself have you received, about existence, about all reality? Practice this self-observation and you see especially where you might be identified with negativity, any negativity. Our February aim in practice is stargazing. And this also helps us self-remember. It's a great way of stopping a negative emotion. Just go outside and look up at the stars. It gives you a sense of scale, the little part that we all play in this massive universe. It helps sometimes reset the emotions. And if you've ever wanted to read about the experience of purification, the emotional center, and contact with higher centers, sometimes you can find it in great literature. And I highly recommend Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov. It's book 3, chapter 7. It's called Cana of Galilee. It's extraordinary, especially the last 2 pages. And I encourage you to read that because he ends up, the main character is Alyosha, he ends up running outside under the stars and falling to the earth and weeping and feeling his freedom for the first time. And lastly, I encourage you to verify for yourself something. This is the video that came to me this week that so spoke to my heart and blessed me. It's a video of David White reading his poem, and it's set to beautiful music in a beautiful context. And to me, this is the essence of what happens when our emotional center is purified. This is the vision for all of us. And watching this video, you can verify for yourself how your emotional center is cleared out and healed. And you might find yourself weeping as I did, which is a special grace of God's healing of our emotional centers. We've covered a lot. I thank you for your attention very much. Marianne, back to you.
Thank you so much, Peter. There's much to digest. Thank you. A closing word from Rodney Collin. Faith is connection with God, inspiration, and grace. Grace comes from above. Christ came by grace. It was a grace that Christ came. Christ came from a virgin by grace. Came in a body by grace. We love by grace. By grace, we can do anything. We have to keep ourselves in grace and keep our connection with Christ. By keeping our grace, we leave all the heaviness of this world and keep the lightness of above. And how do we do this? By prayer. To invoke the name of God is to pray. To invoke the name of God directly from the heart is to put ourselves directly in contact with God. May it be soon that we live with the name of God always in our hearts. Let us join in praying aloud wherever we are, the prayer of God's love. God's love has always met and will always meet all my needs. I give freely and receive joyfully. And how blessed I am to simply remember God. Protect us, Lord, while we stay awake, and watch over us as we sleep, that awake we may keep watch with Christ, and to sleep, rest.